Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of like clinical precision.
Right, yeah, like it's black and white.
Exactly. You fall, your arm hurts, the doctor takes an x-ray, and there's that jagged white line on the bone, and they just point and say, "There it is, broken."
Yeah, and it's binary, it's visible.
And honestly, it's comforting,
Yeah, yeah.
because you know exactly what you're dealing with. You put a cast on it, and you're good.
You have a clear path forward. We really crave that kind of neat categorization in almost everything we look at.
We do. But then you step into the world of global geopolitics and macroeconomics, and suddenly that x-ray machine doesn't just look broken, it's showing you a picture of an entirely different patient.
Yeah, it's a completely different ballgame.
It really is. We're looking at a diagnostic landscape of international relations today that is absolute murky chaos. Every single action has an unseen, cascading reaction across the globe, and literally nothing is a simple binary.
Which is, I mean, that's the perfect lens for today, because the tectonic plates of the global order are actively shifting as we speak.
Right.
And trying to read those shifts requires looking past the obvious fractures, you know? We have to understand the deep underlying stress points.
Absolutely. And so, just to ground us, today is Wednesday, May 13, 2026. U.S. President Donald Trump has just stepped off Air Force One in Beijing to begin a high-stakes two-day summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping.
It's a massive moment.
It is. This is an Atlas Global podcast special deep dive, and we are unpacking the reality behind the pageantry today. I mean, this is Trump's first visit to China in nearly 9 years.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
And they have these incredibly symbolic photo ops lined up, right?
Yeah.
Like at the centuries-old Temple of Heaven, that's the ancient imperial complex built to signify cosmic order and absolute authority. President Trump has even publicly predicted he's expecting a, quote, big fat hug from President Xi.
Which is so interesting because the contrast in diplomatic styles alone is staggering.
Oh.
You have the highly unpredictable transactional nature of the U.S. administration just colliding with Xi's traditionally reserved, hyper-calculated communication style.
Very structured.
Exactly. The optics are entirely designed to project stability and mutual respect.
But optics don't pay the bills, and they don't secure supply chains. So our mission in this deep dive is to look right past those red carpets and the state dinners. We're decoding the actual geopolitical and market forces driving the summit.
And there are a lot of them.
There are.
No.
We have a massive stack of intelligence reports, market analyses, diplomatic cables in front of us. And for you listening, we are going to break down four specific pillars today.
We're looking at the shifting leverage in U.S.-China trade, the absolute tinderbox of the AI and tech race, the profound drain of the ongoing Iran war, and the terrifyingly delicate tightrope of Taiwan policy.
Right. But before we get into the weeds on that, I think we need to set some ground rules for how we're approaching this material.
Yeah, that's a really important point. Because looking strictly at the intelligence and reporting we're analyzing today, and trying to strip away all the intense political emotions surrounding issues like Taiwan's sovereignty or the Iran conflict or U.S. tariff policy, our goal is to remain completely impartial.
Exactly. We are not picking sides here.
No, not at all. We are looking at the chessboard from a purely analytical perspective. We aren't endorsing the actions of Washington or Beijing, Tehran or Taipei. We are just decoding the underlying mechanisms so you, the listener, can understand the actual stakes of this summit.
Perfectly said. So let's start with the one thing that cuts through the diplomatic pageantry faster than anything else, which is money.
Always money.
Right. The global markets are placing their bets on this meeting in real time, and the currency numbers flashing across the terminals this morning are wild. The Chinese yuan just hit a 3-year high.
Yeah, it's significant. The People's Bank of China actually set their daily reference rate at 6.8426 per dollar.
Wow.
And the onshore market actually broke through the 6.8 level.
Okay, wait. For those of us who don't trade forex every single day, let's ground that. What does breaking 6.8 actually mean in practical terms? Like, if I'm an American buying a Chinese-made TV at Walmart, or an American farmer trying to sell soybeans to Shanghai, what does that number do to my wallet?
So it changes the entire pricing dynamic. A stronger yuan, which is what breaking 6.8 represents, means that Chinese goods become slightly more expensive for American consumers.
Okay.
But American goods become cheaper and much more attractive for Chinese buyers. And for years, the U.S. and European nations have accused Beijing of intentionally keeping the yuan artificially weak.
Right, because that helps them sell more stuff.
Exactly. A weak yuan acts as a hidden subsidy. It makes Chinese exports incredibly cheap on the global market, allowing them to basically dominate manufacturing.
So if the yuan is suddenly strengthening right now, that's not an accident.
Oh, not at all. China's currency regime is tightly managed. The yuan is only allowed to fluctuate within a 2% band of that daily reference rate set by their central bank.
I see.
So by allowing the currency to strengthen to a 3-year high right as Trump lands, Beijing is signaling immense domestic economic confidence. Market analysts are reading this as a massive bet on détente.
A hope that they're going to figure things out.
Yeah, a hope that this summit will normalize bilateral relations, cool down the tariff threats, and, you know, revive open trade.
And that economic confidence isn't just a currency manipulation tactic, right? It's backed up by hard data. Because looking at the April trade reports, China just posted a massive trade surplus of $84.8 billion in a single month.
It's a staggering number.
Yeah.
Their exports rose 14.1% year over year, hitting almost $360 billion. Imports jumped over 25%.
Yeah.
And crucially, their surplus specifically with the United States grew by 13%.
Wow.
Yeah, they are riding a massive wave of global demand for their microchips, their consumer electronics, and especially their electric vehicles. So they are walking into the temple of heaven feeling financially bulletproof.
Which brings us to the U.S. side of the table. Because President Trump's historical playbook for dealing with a confident China has always been tariffs. I mean, it was his signature move.
It was the go-to tool.
But looking at the legal analysis from Global Finance Magazine and our sources, it seems the U.S. administration is actually walking into the summit with a severely weakened hand domestically. Why? Because the federal courts have been systematically striking down his use of Section 122 of the Trade Act of 1974.
Yeah, and this is a legal mechanism that fundamentally alters the balance of power in this room. We really have to look at the difference between Section 122 and Section 301 of U.S. trade law.
Okay, lay it out for us.
So during his administration, Trump dusted off Section 122. It was this long-dormant statutory provision originally designed for balance of payments emergencies.
Like severe economic crises.
Right. And he utilized it as a blunt instrument, basically a quick unilateral executive action to slap 10% global duties and triple-digit levies on Chinese goods.
It was essentially a blank check.
Precisely. It bypassed Congress. It bypassed lengthy investigations. It was fast and it's aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
But hundreds of major corporations pushed back on that.
Because it messed up their supply chains.
Exactly. We're talking about massive supply chain players. Costco, Staples, Prada, BYD. They sued the administration, arguing that the executive branch was overstepping its authority. And the federal courts have been agreeing with them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they've been issuing injunctions that are completely eroding that legal foundation.
So if Section 122 was the blank check where the president could just write in a tariff amount, sign it, and immediately disrupt the global market, the courts have essentially ripped up that check.
That's a good way to put it.
And now, according to the sources, the administration is being forced to pivot back to Section 301. It sounds like being forced to fill out a 50-page mortgage application before you can buy a house, right?
Yeah. That analogy captures the bureaucratic pain perfectly, because Section 301 does empower the president to penalize foreign countries for unfair trade practices, but it requires a deeply cumbersome, really slow investigatory process.
Led by the U.S. Trade Representative, right?
Correct. You have to formally define the unfair practice, gather thousands of pages of industry data, hold public hearings, allow for comment periods. I mean, it takes months, if not years.
And a lot of legal fees.
Yeah, and even then, it's subject to massive legal and World Trade Organization challenges.
So the implication of that is massive for the psychology of this summit. Because if China knows that Trump's immediate tariff weapon is currently jammed up in the U.S. court system, they know he is desperate for a visible economic win he can take back to the American public.
He needs a victory lap.
Exactly. Yeah. Something tangible, like getting China to commit to massive purchases of Boeing aircraft or Midwestern agricultural products.
And Beijing is leveraging that desperation. The U.S. has proposed creating a, quote, board of trade, basically a group of senior officials specifically designed to babysit China and ensure they actually follow through on buying those Boeing planes and soybeans.
But China is countering that aggressively, right?
Yeah.
They aren't just playing defense. The documents show Beijing is proposing a reciprocal board of investment.
Yeah, that's their counter move.
They want reduced regulatory barriers for Chinese companies, especially their EV manufacturers, to invest directly in the U.S. market. And they are demanding that certain major Chinese tech firms be removed from U.S. Commerce Department blacklists.
Which is a brilliant tactical pivot, honestly.
Yeah.
They are taking a U.S. demand for agricultural compliance and turning it into a demand for American technological capitulation.
And that leads us perfectly into the second major pillar of the summit. Because if Trump is looking for economic victories, he brought the heavy artillery with him. The passenger list on Air Force One reads like the VIP section of the World Economic Forum.
It really does.
Trump posted that he's traveling with a delegation of the, quote, world's greatest businessmen and women. We are talking about Apple's Tim Cook, Tesla, and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk, and NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang.
The presence of those specific three CEOs is a profound geopolitical statement.
Trump explicitly stated he wants Xi to open up China so these tech giants can work their magic. But I have to push back on the logic here. We have Trump in Beijing acting as an incredibly high-level salesman for American tech. Meanwhile, back in Washington, D.C., the U.S. Congress is frantically trying to build an impenetrable fortress to lock China out of the global tech ecosystem.
Yeah, the cognitive dissonance is deafening.
It really is.
How does that work?
Well, it is the defining contradiction of modern U.S. policy. Because while Trump is asking for market access, Congress is aggressively pushing the MATS Act.
Right, the MATS-EH Act.
And this legislation is designed to categorically restrict Chinese chipmakers and dramatically tighten global AI-related export controls. But the MATS-TCH Act isn't just about stopping an American company from selling a microchip to a Chinese company, right? It goes much deeper into the actual machinery that builds the machinery.
Exactly. This is about the foundational plumbing of the artificial intelligence revolution. The MPCH Act seeks to close secondary loopholes by putting immense diplomatic and economic pressure on allied countries, specifically the Netherlands and Japan.
To do what?
To stop them from selling advanced chip-making equipment to China.
We're talking about companies like ASML in the Netherlands. For anyone listening who isn't deeply embedded in semiconductor supply chains, why is the U.S. Congress so obsessed with a Dutch company?
Because ASML basically holds a global monopoly on extreme ultraviolet or EUV lithography machines.
Okay, EUV lithography.
Right. These are incredibly complex devices, like the size of a city bus, that use lasers and mirrors to print microscopic circuits onto silicon wafers. Without an EUV machine from ASML, or slightly older deep ultraviolet machines from Japan's Tokyo Electron, you simply cannot manufacture the cutting-edge chips required to train advanced AI models.
Wow. So the U.S. strategy is essentially, if we cut off the printing presses, China can't print the chips.
Exactly.
And Beijing is viewing this not just as trade friction, but as coercive technological containment. Essentially, economic warfare.
Yes.
The U.S. justifies this by accusing China of industrial-scale theft of American AI models and intellectual property. But China has its own leverage. They've signaled that if the MATS-EH Act passes, they will activate their malicious entity list. Plus, they dominate the global processing of rare earth minerals.
And that's a massive choke point.
If China cuts off the gallium or germanium that the U.S. tech sector relies on, the American hardware ecosystem just grinds to a halt.
It really is mutually assured economic destruction.
So going back to that passenger list on Air Force One, bringing Jensen Huang to a summit where the U.S. is simultaneously trying to kneecap China's AI capabilities, that feels like bringing the architect of the Death Star to a rebel base.
That's a vivid way to picture it, yeah.
How can the U.S. treat China as an existential AI adversary, accuse them of massive theft, and yet rely on them as the most vital consumer market for Apple and Tesla?
Well, it's because you cannot decouple the revenue from the research.
Yeah.
NVIDIA, Apple, and Tesla rely heavily on the massive revenue generated in the Chinese market to fund their astronomical R&D budgets back in California. If you suddenly sever your biggest revenue stream, you lose the capital needed to out-innovate your rivals. The tech CEOs know this. They are in Beijing to protect their balance sheets.
Which makes sense from a business perspective.
Right. But the U.S. national security apparatus isn't looking at balance sheets. They're looking at cyber warfare capabilities.
And that threat isn't just theoretical. The intelligence reports highlight a terrifying evolution in Chinese state-linked cyber threats, specifically naming campaigns dubbed Volt Typhoon and Salt Typhoon.
And this is where the technological Cold War bleeds into the physical world. For the last two decades, state-sponsored cyber espionage was largely about extraction.
Like stealing files.
Yeah, stealing F-35 blueprints, grabbing corporate trade secrets, or scraping personal data.
But Volt Typhoon is different.
Very different. Volt Typhoon represents a paradigm shift from extraction to prepositioning.
Prepositioning.
Right. These cyber campaigns, which are linked directly to China's Ministry of State Security, are not breaking into U.S. systems to steal data. They're breaking in to build a permanent, hidden home.
Wait, prepositioning. That sounds less like traditional espionage and more like quietly planting landmines in someone else's backyard before war is even declared. Are they actively trying to break the U.S. grid right now?
Not yet. But they're burrowing deep into the digital infrastructure of major U.S. telecom providers, companies like AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile.
That is terrifying.
They are hiding in the routers and switches that control the flow of data to critical infrastructure in the continental U.S. and military hubs like Guam. The intelligence assessment is that if a physical conflict ever erupts, say, over Taiwan, Beijing wants the ability to flip a digital switch and instantly cripple American communications.
To shut it all down.
Yeah, paralyze water treatment plants or shut down power grids.
That is deeply chilling. So while President Trump is sitting at a mahogany table negotiating soybean quotas, there are state-sponsored hackers silently embedded in the very networks that power the U.S. economy.
Yeah.
It just proves you can't isolate one issue. You pull the string on agricultural tariffs and you find it tangled up with microchip supply chains and critical infrastructure sabotage.
And that entanglement is exactly why this bilateral relationship is the single most complex diplomatic challenge of the 21st century.
But the U.S. doesn't have the luxury of focusing purely on Beijing. As much as Washington wants to focus on AI and trade, their attention, their diplomatic bandwidth, and crucially, their military resources are being heavily drained thousands of miles away. We really have to address the geopolitical anchor dragging down U.S. leverage today, which is the ongoing war in Iran.
And this is where the calculus of leverage flips significantly in China's favor.
According to the reports, the ongoing conflict with Iran has severely disrupted global energy supplies, specifically creating a terrifying bottleneck in the Strait of Hormuz. But for Washington, the more immediate crisis is the depletion of U.S. munitions stockpiles.
It's a huge logistical nightmare.
The U.S. military is burning through precision-guided weapons and defense interceptors at an unsustainable rate. And ironically, manufacturing the replacement components for those weapons requires rare earth minerals that, as we just established, are heavily sourced from China.
It's a vicious cycle of dependency. The U.S. is expending resources trying to stabilize the Middle East while simultaneously begging China for the materials needed to replenish those resources.
And the reports suggest Trump is highly motivated to get Xi Jinping to lean on Tehran to advance peace talks and reopen the Strait of Hormuz. But I'm looking at this and wondering, why is China suddenly the power broker in the Middle East? Historically, their policy has been strict non-interference.
Right. They usually just stay out of it.
Exactly. They buy oil, they build infrastructure, and they stay out of the messy politics.
Well, the non-interference policy basically died the moment China's domestic economy was threatened by the conflict. We've seen intense Chinese shuttle diplomacy leading up to this summit. Just a few weeks ago, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi hosted the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi in Beijing.
So what is the mechanism driving China's involvement there?
It really comes down to the brutal math of petrochemicals. Roughly half of China's crude oil imports have to pass through the Strait of Hormuz.
Half. Wow.
Yeah, and because of the ongoing war and the resulting spike in global oil prices, the cost of production for Chinese petrochemical products, which are the foundational plastics and materials used in almost all their manufacturing, has skyrocketed by 20%.
That's a massive hit to their margins.
Exactly. China's massive export machine relies on cheap inputs. They desperately want that waterway unblocked because they fear a prolonged energy crisis could trigger a global recession.
And a global recession means nobody buys their stuff.
Right, which would destroy international demand for the very exports that are currently keeping their economy afloat.
But the sources also indicate China is playing a highly calculated double game here. While they are feeling the pinch on plastics, they aren't facing the same existential energy panic that, say, Europe might.
Correct. China has spent the last decade building massive domestic petroleum reserves for exactly this scenario. Furthermore, they have a massive foundational energy baseload provided by domestic coal, and they lead the world in green renewable energy deployments.
So they have a cushion.
They do. They have built an energy buffer that shields them from the worst of the crisis.
So the relationship between China and Iran isn't based on deep ideological alignment or shared values. It's described in the reports as entirely asymmetrical and opportunistic.
It is purely transactional. China certainly wants the Strait of Hormuz open, But they're also watching the United States exhaust its military resources, drain its financial capital, and burn through its political goodwill in an endless, grinding Middle Eastern conflict.
It's like China is watching the U.S. play an exhausting trillion-dollar game of whack-a-mole in the Middle East, and Beijing is just sitting at the prize counter charging us for the mallet.
That's incredibly accurate. From Beijing's perspective, a distracted, financially depleted United States is a massive strategic advantage.
Of course.
If the U.S. fails to, quote, finish the job in Iran, if it cannot secure a stable peace or a definitive military outcome, it shatters U.S. credibility worldwide. Every middle power in the Middle East, Africa, and Asia is watching this.
Watching to see if the U.S. can still hold things together.
Right. And if they see that Washington can no longer guarantee regional security, they will naturally pivot to Beijing to fill that vacuum.
But Beijing isn't going to hand the U.S. a geopolitical victory in the Middle East for free. If Trump is explicitly asking Xi to spend his political capital to pressure Tehran into peace talks, Xi is going to demand a monumental concession in return. And the currency he is going to demand is Taiwan.
Without question. The road to peace in the Middle East, at least in the context of this summit, runs directly through Taipei.
And the diplomatic maneuvering around this is incredibly aggressive. Just days ahead of this summit, the Chinese embassy in the U.S. published a formal list of four red lines that must not be challenged during Trump's visit. Sitting right at the very top of that list, non-negotiable, is the Taiwan question.
And the timing there is highly deliberate. Beijing is reacting to the fact that the U.S. recently authorized an $11 billion arms package to Taiwan.
Which is the largest in history, right?
Yes, the largest ever. And there is reportedly another $14 billion package sitting in the pipeline awaiting final approval. This infuriated the Chinese government, prompting massive military encirclement exercises around the island.
China wants Trump to use his executive authority to delay or significantly reduce those arms sales. But reading through the diplomatic cables, it's not just about the hardware, is it? It's not just about stopping the delivery of F-16s or Harpoon missiles. It's about the literal words being used by the State Department.
Yes, and this brings us to the incredibly dense, high-stakes world of declaratory policy.
Declaratory policy?
It's exactly. For decades, the official United States stance regarding Taiwan has been meticulously, painstakingly calibrated. The official language is that the U.S. does not support Taiwan independence. It is a passive, nuanced phrase that maintains the status quo of strategic ambiguity.
But Beijing is pushing for a change in vocabulary. They are heavily pressuring the Trump administration to officially change the diplomatic language from does not support to explicitly stating that the U.S. opposes Taiwan independence.
And to a casual observer, the difference between does not support and opposes might sound like a distinction without a difference.
It sounds like pure semantics.
It does.
Let me try to contextualize this because I think it's vital for you listening to understand. Changing a few words in a diplomatic communique, it's like changing a single line of code deep in the software of a commercial airliner. To a passenger sitting in 12B looking at a screen, changing a 0 to a 1 in the background code looks completely minor, totally irrelevant. But to the aerospace engineers, they know that changing that one specific line of code alters the plane's fly-by-wire system, shuts off the engines, and crashes the whole plane into the ocean. Is that what we're talking about with this language?
That is a flawless way to understand it. In international diplomacy, precedent is everything. If the United States officially adopts the word opposes, Beijing can instantly exploit that subtle change as a massive geopolitical victory.
How so?
They will take that U.S. declaration and use it to bludgeon every other nation on Earth, pressuring them to adopt the exact same restrictive language.
Which effectively isolates Taiwan even further.
Yes. It risks eroding the legitimacy of any future U.S. economic or military engagement with Taipei. It severely depresses morale within Taiwanese society. And it fundamentally shifts the baseline of military deterrence in the Pacific.
Which explains the absolute panic rippling through the region right now. We know President Trump views foreign policy through a highly transactional lens. He looks for deals. He looks for leverage. So how real is the fear in Taipei that Taiwan's security could literally be traded away? Could Trump concede on that declaratory language or pause the arms sales in exchange for a massive agricultural purchase or a guarantee that China will rein in Iran?
The fear isn't just real in Taipei. It is the dominant anxiety across the entire Indo-Pacific. Every single U.S. ally in the region is watching this summit, terrified of a scenario where Washington and Beijing make a grand bilateral bargain that completely sidelines the security interests of everyone else.
Look at the reaction from Japan. The sources highlight that Japan's Prime Minister, Sanae Takaichi, actually rushed to Washington back in March. That visit wasn't routine.
No, it was an emergency trip.
It was specifically timed to happen before this Trump-Xi summit to desperately ensure Japan's regional interests weren't put on the chopping block. Prime Minister Takaichi and her cabinet have been frantically traveling to Vietnam, Australia, and the Philippines.
They are trying to build a coalition of middle powers. They are advocating for the free and open Indo-Pacific framework because they realize they can no longer rely on the U.S. to unilaterally hold the line if Washington is busy cutting bilateral deals.
And South Korea is in a similar bind. Their economy and their security are intimately tied to both the U.S. and China. Seoul is quietly calculating the collateral damage here. For example, there's an ongoing U.S. Trade Representative investigation into Chinese shipbuilding practices.
Right, that's a huge industry for them.
Depending on how Trump handles that specific investigation during the summit, it could either massively boost South Korean shipbuilders or completely devastate them. They're at the mercy of a meeting they aren't even invited to.
Even India is deeply alarmed. A report from the Stimson Center highlights the fragility of the current U.S.-India relationship. It's been rocky recently due to trade disputes and U.S. maneuvering with Pakistan.
Right. And India historically views the U.S. as the only reliable superpower capable of countering China's influence in the Himalayas and the Indian Ocean.
But if President Trump emerges from the Temple of Heaven, signaling a softening of competition with China, or worse, signaling that the U.S. is content to leave Asian security largely to Beijing's devices, it would be a catastrophic blow to the U.S.-India strategic partnership. New Delhi would immediately back away from joint military initiatives and reevaluate their entire global posture.
So we have these four massive tectonic plates grinding against each other: tariffs, AI, Iran, and Taiwan. But reading deeper into the briefings, there is a layer of highly volatile wildcard issues resting right on top of those plates. These are seemingly smaller, distinct issues, but any one of them possesses the kinetic energy to derail the entire summit.
And in a normal geopolitical climate, any single one of these wildcards would be complex enough to merit its own dedicated multi-day summit. Here, they are just footnotes in a much larger chaotic agenda.
Let's run through the mechanics of these wildcards. First, the human rights portfolio. Over 100 U.S. lawmakers, we're talking about a massive bipartisan coalition representing almost two-thirds of the Senate, have sent a public letter demanding that Trump secure the release of Jimmy Lai.
Right. And Jimmy Lai is the 78-year-old pro-democracy publisher and billionaire who has been languishing in a Hong Kong prison since 2020 under sweeping national security laws.
And Trump actually made a pledge to secure his freedom during his 2024 campaign. But human rights, and specifically the internal governance of Hong Kong, is explicitly listed by the Chinese embassy as another one of their non-negotiable four red lines. It touches on the core issue of Chinese sovereignty.
Then you have the deeply destabilizing North Korea wildcard.
Oh, right. We all saw the shocking footage recently of North Korean troops actually participating in Russia's Victory Day parade in Moscow.
Yeah, that imagery fundamentally altered the security calculus in East Asia. It underscores the deepening militarized entrenchment of the North Korea-Russia partnership.
It's a scary alliance.
Very. And it raises a critical mechanical question for the negotiators in Beijing. Does China actually possess sufficient leverage over Pyongyang anymore? Even if Trump successfully pressures Xi to broker renewed engagement with Kim Jong-un, North Korea's warming ties with Vladimir Putin mean Beijing might not have the leash they once held.
And speaking of existential threats, the nuclear arms control wildcard is sitting right there, too.
The nuclear portfolio is a massive point of silent friction. The Trump administration has pushed aggressively for comprehensive nuclear arms control talks that include China, not just Russia.
But China isn't interested.
No, because China looks at the raw numbers. Their nuclear arsenal is significantly smaller than the U.S. or Russia's, and they see absolutely no strategic benefit in capping their growth. They refuse to engage.
So the U.S. response, according to the sources, has been to threaten a resumption of live nuclear testing.
Yes. The U.S. claims China has conducted secret, low-yield nuclear tests despite global unilateral moratoriums. Washington is threatening to resume testing, quote, on an equal basis.
But if the U.S. actually follows through on that threat and detonates a nuclear weapon in Nevada, it completely unravels decades of global non-proliferation norms.
Mm-hmm.
It's a massive escalation just to force a conversation.
Exactly.
And finally, we have the fentanyl crisis. This is a massive domestic political issue for Trump. The U.S. wants China to aggressively crack down on the domestic chemical businesses that are supplying the raw precursors to Mexican cartels.
But we have to understand the mechanic of how that supply chain works. China argues that these chemicals have legitimate industrial uses, and policing thousands of small chemical exporters is nearly impossible. More importantly, China has attached a diplomatic prerequisite to their cooperation.
They want off the list.
Exactly. Before Beijing will commit to deploying domestic law enforcement against these chemical suppliers, they're demanding that the U.S. State Department officially remove China from the humiliating list of major drug transit or illicit drug-producing countries.
It's transactionalism at every conceivable level. So putting this all together, trying to solve all of this simultaneously feels like trying to put out a raging house fire while simultaneously negotiating the sale of the house while arguing with the neighbor about where the property line is drawn.
That is exactly what it is.
How do these seemingly smaller wild cards like fentanyl precursors or the imprisonment of Jimmy Lai actually trigger a cascading failure of the broader trillion-dollar trade and geopolitical negotiations?
Because in high-stakes diplomacy, absolute linkage is the rule. Nothing exists in a vacuum. Every issue is a lever physically welded to another issue. If the U.S. delegation pushes too hard on securing Jimmy Lai's release, explicitly crossing a sovereign Chinese red line, President Xi might simply stand up and walk away from the Boeing and soybean purchase agreements.
It's a domino effect.
Exactly. If China refuses to budge on regulating fentanyl precursors, Trump might retaliate by refusing to grant any waivers on semiconductor export controls. A sudden breakdown in trust over the rhetoric surrounding nuclear arms control could instantly poison the atmosphere required to reach a fragile trade truce.
It is an incredibly fragile ecosystem, held together by nothing more than perceived leverage and the personal chemistry of two very different leaders. Which brings us to the summary of this massive Atlas Global podcast special deep dive.
And looking at the sheer volume of interlinked crises we've covered today, it's clear why the markets and military commands are on edge.
To quickly recap the incredible complexity of what is happening in Beijing right now, this is not just a photo op at the Temple of Heaven. It is a profound, real-time stress test of the entire global operating system. We are watching two superpowers attempt to navigate a landscape driven by the crumbling legal foundations of tariff strategies, the existential economic stakes of an AI Cold War, the agonizing military drain of the war in Iran, and the terrifyingly fragile status of Taiwan's sovereignty.
It is a moment of profound uncertainty, and yet there's a concept that quietly emerged from the diplomatic sources that offers a glimpse into a potential paradigm-shifting future for all of us.
Yes, and this is our final provocative thought for you, the listener, to ponder long after this deep dive ends. It's a concept known in diplomatic circles as G2 diplomacy.
G2 diplomacy. The idea was first floated during the financial crisis decades ago, but the pressure of this summit is roaring it back into the conversation. It is the concept that the world's two largest powers, the United States and China, realizing that global institutions are too slow and unwieldy, could essentially bypass the UN, bypass traditional multilateral alliances, and jointly shape the global political and economic order, a group of two.
So think about the implications of that. What if the ultimate result of this Trump-Xi summit isn't a clear-cut decisive victory for the United States, and it isn't a victory for China? What if the outcome is a tacit, quiet agreement between them to jointly rule the global order?
That's the real question.
If Washington and Beijing sit down in that room and decide to simply carve up the world's economic zones and security policies between the two of them, what happens to the sovereignty, the economic independence, and the safety of all the middle powers? What happens to Japan, South Korea, Europe, and India when they are left on the outside, looking in through the window while their futures are decided for them?
It is a chilling, entirely plausible, and deeply fascinating possibility. And it brings us right back to where we started our conversation today.
We started by talking about the comfort of an X-ray, the deeply human desire for a clean binary diagnosis, broken or not broken, good guy, bad guy, win or lose. But as we've seen today, looking at the geopolitics of trade, AI, and war, that X-ray machine is utterly useless. The reality of the global order is murky, it's terrifyingly interconnected, and it's constantly shifting beneath our feet.
There are no clean lines anymore. There are only complex webs of leverage and consequence.
Thank you so much for joining us for this Atlas Global Podcast special deep dive. We hope we helped clear away a little bit of that murkiness and showed you the mechanisms driving the headlines. Keep questioning what you read. Keep looking for the hidden connections in the supply chains, and we will see you next time.